From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the Texas National Guard rejects the Pentagon's directive to recognize same-sex marriage. Will that decision have deep and long-term consequences for the military in Texas? In less than a month, the Obamacare online exchanges go live. What will happen to Texas health insurance premiums and jobs as the Affordable Care Act is implemented? And are Bible quotes too much religion for Texas high school football breakthrough banners? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This week, the Texas National Guard announced it will not provide benefits for same-sex married couples, despite a Pentagon's directive requiring the military to treat all marriages equally. Major General John Nichols, the commanding general of the Texas Military Forces, said in a memo that the Texas Constitution and the state's family code conflicts with the Defense Department's policy. The Texas National Guard is now requesting guidance from the Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott, who is running for governor and has a long history of fighting against same-sex marriage equality. Chris Rousey is the National Guard Affairs Liaison for the American Military Partners Association.
Texas National Guard is not fully supporting all of their military members. It's my understanding that they have taken the position that they will not on any National Guard property process the entitlements that have been, by law, actually, via the Supreme Court decision, been guaranteed to our military members who are in same-sex marriages. It's unfortunate. We are, of course, extremely disappointed that they would take this political position that now harms our military members.
I didn't know that the Texas National Guard could refuse an order or directive coming from the Pentagon.
Well, I think whether or not they can will ultimately be determined. I'm not sure that they have a very strong legal leg to stand on. They are in large part, and if I were to hazard a percentage guess, I would say roughly 90 to 95% funded from federal funding. There is very little state money that goes into a National Guard unit for the majority of the National Guard's mission, air or army. So I'm a little astounded that they would try to take that position, although I guess if we look historically, it shouldn't be completely surprising because there were similar positions taken from some Guard units in the South during the Civil Rights Movement. And ultimately, I believe historically what happened was the Pentagon threatened to pull that federal funding, and that finally got their attention. I'm not sure whether or not the Pentagon or the White House has weighed in on this situation yet, but I would certainly think they would like to. 90 to 95% of the equipment on a National Guard, be it Army or Air Base, is owned and funded by the federal government. The majority of their manpower, particularly their full-time personnel positions, are federally funded. Those people are either active guard, which means they are Title 32, or they are federal employees. So all of their personnel funding is federal funding. Their operations and maintenance budgets, their travel budgets, their education and training budgets, all of that is federal funded. So I believe what would happen is if federal funding were cut off for those guard units would then cease to exist. So I am quite astounded that they would take that position, but even more so hurt that they would use this political football in a way that harms our military members who are doing their jobs by defending this country, and they take this position for political reasons. It's very, very disappointing.
I immediately recalled 1957, Little Rock. The governor of Arkansas called out the National Guard to prevent the Little Rock Nine from going to school, integrated schools, after Brown versus the Board of Education. Eisenhower then nationalized the Little Rock National Guard, sent them all home, and then he sent in the 101st Airborne Division to secure the peace in Little Rock.
So I do recall that historically, and that's accurate. Certainly, the White House could federalize the National Guard in all of these states and require them to then process these benefits for our military members. He could certainly do that. The White House could certainly do that. That would be a very drastic step, and I would hope that the governors of these states would certainly consider the potential ramifications of their actions before they took this stance.
Well, let's talk about how this impacts real people, people who want to get the same-sex benefits that if they're in the Texas National Guard and if they were happen to be in a different state's National Guard and they're getting those benefits, what are they being deprived of?
Well, for starters, they're depriving the spouses and families of these military members from the support that their heterosexual counterparts receive. I mean, just imagine a National Guardsman deploying to a hostile fire zone. You know, bases go out of their way to ensure that family members are fully supported during those periods of time. Their phone calls are made to make sure they're doing okay, you know, that they're able to come out to the units, to functions, and receive that emotional support that they need. And even things like notification if something were to happen to the person, those are all tied to the registration in DEERS, which is the personnel system that registers the marriage. Those are all tied to that DEERS enrollment.
Let me just address that for a second. That's a great benefit to have, but the military, my understanding is they're not doing that because they want to be nice. They want their fighting force on the ground to have their mind where they are. You know, they don't want them to have their minds back home worrying about what their loved one is enduring.
That is exactly correct. It's a readiness issue. It is completely a personnel readiness issue, and it has an impact on a soldier or an airman or a sailor's ability to focus on the job at hand. And certainly when you're in a hostile fire zone, you need to be focusing on the job at hand, not worrying about whether or not your spouse back home is being fully supported while they try to maintain the home front while you're away. So it absolutely is a readiness issue. You know, I think the Texas Guard is trying to play it off as simply a minor inconvenience, that these folks can travel to any active duty military station and enroll, and then they don't have to worry about it. But I've also been given to understand that even once they receive those ID cards, if they then try to go to a National Guard facility, they will still be turned away, and their relationship will not be recognized. So they still won't be able to receive the type of support that they should get. Those family support programs, you know, things where the family can come out and receive briefings on their benefits and all those types of things are allegedly not going to be offered to the family members. So that's just an added burden on the military member that they have to think about when they're, you know, out there in the hostile fire zone.
How is this going to be resolved?
You know, that's a really good question. I think what we would like to see is perhaps the Pentagon and or the White House stepping in and doing everything they can to try to encourage these governors to do what's right, because that's what this really is about. This is not about politics. This isn't about any particular political agenda. This is about doing what's right for our military members and their families. And if the governors themselves can't come to the realization that this is the right thing to do, then I would think that the Pentagon or the White House would consider stepping in to try to show them the right thing to do.
Well, it is about politics, unfortunately. And from a strategic point of view, I mean, of course, all the authority and the dollars and all that is coming from the White House and from the Pentagon, coming from Washington, D.C. to support the Texas National Guard. And for them to take on this fight, it doesn't seem like there is a positive outcome for them. I mean, they're eventually going to have to capitulate.
I would certainly think they should realize that, yes. I don't see an outcome where they are able to continue with this position. I don't believe it's legal. Now, of course, I'm not an attorney, but I do not personally believe that it's legal. I think eventually they will be made to comply with the DOD directive one way or the other. So I'm not really sure what was in their minds when they decided to take this position. Texas was, of course, the first one to do it, but I've also understand that Louisiana and Mississippi are also taking this position now. So, you know, this isn't just one solitary state that has decided to try to do something that harms our the readiness of our military as well as, you know, the families back home.
Chris Rousey is the National Guard Affairs Liaison for the American Military Partners Association. There are nearly 6 million people in Texas without health insurance. The majority will be able to get coverage when the federally run marketplace opens a month from now, but not everyone. As KERA's Lauren Silverman reports, undocumented immigrants are excluded under the Affordable Care Act.
Every afternoon, Ninfa rings up groceries at La Michoacana Meat Market in Dallas. She's been there 6 years and scans packets of queso fresco and jamón with impressive speed. A decade ago, Ninfa, who doesn't want us to use her last name, was a student in Mexico and got healthcare for free. Now, when she gets sick or needs a checkup, she takes a bus across town to a clinic run by Parkland Hospital. Each visit costs $22. Ninfa says there are requirements. You have to present a pay stub, identification, and proof of Dallas County residency. But they don't ask for proof of citizenship. She says not all undocumented immigrants know about this type of health clinic. A lot, she says, are afraid to seek care and end up at the emergency room. Ninfa says she knows people who've gone to the ER at Parkland, and every month they get a bill for $800. Some go 5-6 years without a checkup, she says. They go in to give birth without even knowing whether the baby is healthy. Skipping care is not only risky, it's expensive for both the uninsured and taxpayers, because public hospitals end up footing the bill. It's hard to find out just how much is spent treating the undocumented. Most hospitals don't ask about immigration status. But in 2010, Texas says public hospital districts spent $717 million for uncompensated care. Proponents of the Affordable Care Act argue the law will save money because more people will be insured, see doctors, and avoid the ER. Problem is,
undocumented immigrants are one of the groups that are categorically excluded from the penalties as well as the benefits of the Affordable Care Act.
Devin Herrick is a health economist at the National Center for Policy Priorities. He says, on the one hand, the undocumented won't be required to get insurance. On the other, they won't be able to buy insurance in the new marketplace. Not allowing this group of people, who tend to be younger and healthier, into the national healthcare system could cost the country.
It would benefit the risk pool to have a lot of young, healthy people in the marketplace. And so, at the very least, it would be good for not just immigrants, but everyone to have access to affordable coverage.
In Texas, 800,000 of the people without insurance are undocumented. Herrick worries many of them will still end up in the ER at places like Parkland, which wouldn't comment for this story.
A lot of safety net hospitals are going to be struggling because they cannot be guaranteed they will actually attract the patients that have the health coverage. And if they continue to attract those who don't have health coverage, at the same time they're losing some of their subsidies to help cover those with that health coverage, they're going to have problems because of the cost.
That's why the Affordable Care Act aims to steer the uninsured into community clinics, places like Los Barrios Unidos in West Dallas. This clinic already serves more than 20,000 patients a year. CEO Leonor Marquez.
Most of the folks we see are working poor, working folks. The vast majority do not have health insurance.
Los Barrios Unidos received $5 million from the Affordable Care Act to open a new building in South Oak Cliff.
What we already see now is unmet demand, especially with people who don't have a regular source of care.
Workers at Los Barrios Unidos don't usually ask patients about immigration status. That will change in October when it comes time to sign people up for Obamacare.
Of the 300 patients that we see today, perhaps two-thirds of them don't have health insurance. Now, if another third of them have health insurance, that helps us cover our costs in providing care.
Marquez says reimbursements from insurance companies and the government will go toward hiring doctors and nurses who will treat anyone, whether or not they're documented. Lauren Silverman, KERA News.
State GOP opposition has been busy doing all they can to block, stymie, and confuse the rollout of the Affordable Care law. So there's been a lot of conflicting information about what the program will do and what it won't do, and what impact it'll have on the overall economy and household budgets. The nonpartisan RAND Corporation crunched the numbers for Texas and a few other states, looking to see what will happen to health insurance premiums with Obamacare. And in Texas, they found that they will either stay steady or they'll rise slightly, but that's mainly due to the fact that the Texas Republican leadership did not expand Medicaid. Had they done that, then Texas would see a slight reduction in premiums. It's complicated and wonkish, and to help us get a better understanding, I spoke with one of the study's authors, senior economist Christine Eibner.
In the individual market in particular, there was a lot of variability in health insurance premiums, but we didn't find evidence of a systematic and dramatic increase in health insurance premiums. For many states, we found that premiums stayed roughly the same, and including Texas was one of those states where we found, you know, roughly equivalent premiums before and or with and without the ACA.
Different states are seeing very different outcomes. And one reason for that is that some states did do the Medicaid expansion and some states like Texas did not. How is that impacting the outcomes that your study came up with?
Right. So for Texas, we looked at how premiums we looked at the amount of premiums in scenarios where we included the Medicaid expansion and scenarios where we excluded the Medicaid expansion. And what we found that was for Texas and for two other states that are actually not going to expand Medicaid, we found that premiums in the non-group market or the individual market go up slightly if Medicaid is not expanded. And the reason is that if Medicaid is not expanded, the exchanges are open to a broader subset of low-income individuals, and some of those individuals have higher spending, and that in turn affects the premiums for the overall market.
So you said earlier that in the study you didn't see a big increase in premiums in Texas under the Affordable Care Act, but it sounds like you're saying if Texas had expanded Medicaid, then maybe premiums would have gone down?
Potentially premiums could have gone down or maybe no change if Texas did not expand Medicaid. When we compare the case of Texas expanding Medicaid to Texas not expanding Medicaid, we find about a 9% increase in premiums in the situation where Medicaid is not expanded.
And the reason that this is critical is because if Medicaid had expanded in the state, which the federal government was going to pick up the tab for, now we're going to take those people who are generally more impoverished, more likely to have greater healthcare issues. They're going to enter into the risk pool that we would have in the Obamacare marketplace.
Right. Some of them will end up entering in that risk pool. Some of those lower income and more impoverished people will enter into the risk pool for the marketplaces. But of course, a large fraction of them will actually remain uninsured.
Well, how can they remain uninsured?
Well, if Medicaid is not expanded in Texas, then there are a number of individuals who don't have access to affordable coverage. And so many of them will choose not to enroll in a health insurance plan. Some of them will move on to the marketplaces.
Isn't it required to join the marketplace? And even if you're impoverished, because then you get like tax credits that will offset what it would cost to join the marketplace?
So the tax credits are actually only available to people with incomes above 100% of the federal poverty level. So, and that's because the Affordable Care Act, I guess when it was originally written, it envisioned that people below that level would have access to Medicaid. So then when Medicaid was not expanded, there ended up being this gap for low-income individuals who were below 100% of the federal poverty level and didn't already qualify for Medicaid through some other channel.
So in Texas, which is right now we have the largest percentage of people who have no health insurance, even after on January 1st when the Affordable Care Act goes into effect, we still could have a considerable pool of people that have no health insurance.
That's correct.
Any idea how big that's going to be?
So we did estimate that. Let's see. For Texas, we predict that 12% of the non-elderly population will continue to be uninsured even with the Affordable Care Act.
Wow. Okay. That's new to me. In addition to alterations in what the premiums, how much we're going to be paying, and it sounds to me like you're saying that Texas is going to see, you said between 8 and 9% possible increase in premiums?
That 8 or 9% increase in premiums is relative to a case where Texas does expand its Medicaid program. So that's not a clean comparison of, you know, with and without the ACA. It's more of a comparison of two scenarios where the ACA is fully enacted, but one scenario Texas expands Medicaid and one scenario it does not expand Medicaid.
Okay, but we know Texas is not going to expand Medicaid. We know that. That's not an unknown. So what do we know about what's going to happen to the premiums?
So our main scenario we looked at, we actually assumed that Texas did expand its Medicaid program by 2016. And there we saw about a 10% decline in premiums, although it was not statistically significant, meaning that we couldn't rule out the possibility that that was due to statistical sampling or statistical noise. When we compared this to a scenario where Texas did not expand Medicaid, most of that decrease was washed out. So we end up about at the level we would have been without any change in policy.
So, I mean, at the end of the day, that means the premiums roughly remain the same?
Yes.
For most people, don't they get their insurance through their employer?
Most people do, yes.
And so where is that going?
So we see very little change in the employer market in terms of premiums and the amount people would be paying.
So you're not seeing job providers being squeezed by Obamacare?
Job providers being squeezed?
I have a small business and I provide insurance to my employees. I'm not going to see premiums skyrocket on my end and make me kick people off of on my payroll off insurance.
Among employers that are already providing health insurance, we see very little change in premium. So it doesn't look like the Affordable Care Act is going to have a big effect on the expenses for employers that are already providing insurance to their workers. Now, for an employer that's not providing insurance, and that the effects are different, and that's simply because now many of those employers will have to begin providing insurance to their workers, and so that creates a new expense for them.
Right. Okay, so we're hearing these horror stories of employers saying that they're going to have put many of their people on part-time because they can't afford the Affordable Care Act requirements, but you're saying that's not there.
Well, so we actually didn't look at that behavioral response of putting people onto part-time in order to avoid. So the issue there is that if a worker is part-time, while there's this employer mandate where you would have to pay penalties for if your workers don't have access to health insurance coverage, those penalties don't apply to workers who work less than 30 hours a week. And so some firms, to try to avoid those penalties, might reduce hours for workers. And that's not a question that we analyzed in this report, the extent of that behavior.
Right, and that is only for if employers who are not providing health insurance.
Correct.
Okay, so it seems like, you know, you guys crunched the numbers and looking at the predictions of what the Affordable Care Act is going to do for, you know, the tabletop. And that's where people are very concerned about. And so what was the biggest challenge in coming up with this information?
Oh, well, there's so much uncertainty in terms of how insurers are going to respond and in terms of how people are going to respond. And we're trying to predict this using, you know, economic theory and data. And we've tried to do a very rigorous job. But, of course, in the end, there's a, you know, element of uncertainty just because we don't know about these complex behavioral changes. So I think that was our biggest challenge.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you have very determined political figures in states that are doing all they can to obstruct Obamacare, and so that's got to be a complication as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a bunch of behavioral and ideological issues that are very difficult to capture in a simulation modeling approach.
Christine Eibner is a senior economist at the RAND Corporation. She is an author of a report on the impact of Obamacare on Texas health insurance premiums, which says they are likely to remain steady or increase, mainly because Texas rejected the expansion of Medicaid. The start of the school year means it's time again for Friday Night Lights and the ritual of local high school football. One ritual is the hometown Gridiron Heroes bursting through a giant paper breakthrough banner painted by the booster squad and the cheerleaders with slogans about team spirit and scoring many touchdowns. Except in Koontz, Texas, north of Beaumont, near the Louisiana border, the Koontz High School cheerleaders used their breakthrough banners to promote biblical scripture and evangelize Christianity. That's according to the Texas ACLU. The American Civil Liberties Union is joining a coalition of religious groups in saying the banners violate the separation of church and state. Rebecca Robertson is the legal and policy director for the ACLU of Texas.
Koontz High School cheerleaders sued the school district, and they are arguing with each other about who has what rights with respect to these Bible verses run-through banners that the school has authorized for use at high school football games. The case is on appeal, and so we took this opportunity with a coalition of interfaith groups to weigh in a friend of the court brief, an amicus brief, to set the record straight about what the Constitution permits and does not permit.
So the cheerleaders sued the school board because the school board originally told them stop putting Bible verses on the football run-through banners.
Right. The school board got a complaint, and while it investigated that complaint, it stopped that practice of letting them put those Bible banners up. But to be clear, the school board has said that it's okay with them if the kids do it, and before it got the complaint, it had authorized them to do it. So at least with respect to the Bible banners, the school board and the cheerleaders are on the same side. They're both saying that it's permissible under the Constitution. And we disagree because it is the school district endorsing a particular religious belief, Christian belief, in a way that sends the message that kids who are not Christians or who are non-believers are outsiders in the school community.
What are some of the slogans or sayings that are popping up on these banners?
Well, for instance, they say things like, I can do all things through Christ, which strengthens me, or thanks be to God, which gives victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. And so they're very expressly Christian messages. And you can imagine the position that a football player who's Jewish or Muslim or a non-believer would be in if he is forced to decide, should I run through the banner like all my peers in front of this huge crowd, or should I take a stand for my belief in front of this huge crowd? That's a terrible position to put kids in. And so that's why we wanted to weigh in.
Now, is this new? Had this never been done before? Or is this a long-standing practice of putting Bible verses on breakthrough banners? I don't remember seeing them in my day when I played high school football. How did this come about?
Well, as I understand it, the cheerleaders came up with this idea in 2012 and took it to the official sponsors of the cheerleader squad, who are paid employees of the school district charged with overseeing the squad, and they asked for whether the school district would be okay with them doing it. And the squad sponsors said, sure, that's fine. We think it's a great idea.
But this is outside of the classroom. It's not even during the school hours. It's an extracurricular activity.
That is true. And it's an extracurricular activity that's very important to kids across Texas. Kids have the right to be able to participate in school activities like football games or graduation or school programs without having to worry that they're going to be confronted with evangelizing sponsored by their school.
So what if they're playing the team called the Devils? Can they have like a breakthrough banner that says, convert the Devils to losing or something?
That might be a closer call, David, but that's not what these banners said. These banners were direct Bible verses that not only cited the chapter and verse, but made express reference to Jesus Christ. So it's a very personal issue that was going up on these 30 by 10 banners for the whole school to observe.
Rebecca Robertson is the legal and policy director of the ACLU of Texas. They are joining a lawsuit which argues the biblical verses on football breakthrough banners of Koontz High School violates the Constitution. And that is it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. You can send emails about the program to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also comment directly on our website. That's at tpr.org. And there you can also listen to past Texas Matters programs. And you can listen to us also on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.